The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And I'll just add to that announcement that the Friday Dharma Practice Day is going to focus on, it's the last of the series, and the focus is the equanimity, the Brahmavihara, the divine abode, the form of love that in Buddhism is recognized as a kind of form of equanimity. And there'll be a series of guided meditations and discussions and exercises around that topic. By the time I finish this talk this evening, you probably understand that the less I say, the better. And so let's see how many words it takes to say that, explain that. So there's a time for action, and there's a time for no action. There's a time to do things, and there's a time for not doing. And it's probably fair to say that, as a generalization, that for most people, that they err on the side of doing and don't really understand very well the aspect of non-doing, especially the deep possibilities of non-doing. And that as people do this Buddhist practice, that at some point it's important to learn about not doing anything. And the less done, the better. On Friday, I went to San Quentin, and which I do every year or so. I bring a bunch of chaplaincy students that I'm training, Buddhist chaplaincy, to visit some programs in the prison there. And this year we went to visit a program that was, it's called Guiding Rage into Power, which was taking 28 lifers, most of them people who had, most of them inmates who had murdered people. Some of them had been in prison for over 30 years. And offering them, kind of inspired, I think, a little bit from mindfulness practice, but offering them a whole program to transform their anger, transform their hurt, transform their aggression, transform themselves, so they become peacemakers. They become people who can bring peace to the prison and support other people in making this transformation. And we were introduced to one of these 28 men who had gone through the program the year before, so it's a year-long program. And he'd now returned to be trained to be a facilitator in the program, to be trained. And the goal of this program is for the inmates to be able to teach this program to themselves rather than bring volunteers in from the outside. And it seemed like it was, I didn't quite get the year, but it seemed like it was just earlier this year, just a little while ago, something happened to this man. And that was... he was sent to solitary confinement and for 60 days, but he didn't know why. And he was very perplexed by why he was sent there. And later he discovered why he was sent to solitary confinement. And the reason is that, it was very strange, everyone, he just suddenly, in San Quentin, your faith can change, you know, in a minute. And so no one else knew why he went either. So here was this person who was facilitating, training people to, you know, to wisely deal with anger, to be a peacemaker, and all that. Suddenly, he was in the hole, right, in solitary confinement. So, what he eventually found out was that, well, what he knew, he used to be part of a very notorious gang, one of the worst in California, I guess. And there was a rumor in the prison that members in the prison of that gang, former members, were out to harm someone else in the prison. which this kind of thing happens in jails. But no one was named. There was no name associated, just someone from that gang, or from who had been in that gang. So there's a certain logic then, if you want to avoid that kind of violence, there's a certain logic that you take everyone who's known to be a member of that gang, or had been a member of that gang, and put them all in solitary confinement, because then they can't do anything. So he suddenly found himself in solitary confinement and didn't understand why. And he said he spent the first 2 weeks standing in his cell. He said first when he knew he was going to be told he was going to go there. I don't know if he meant to say he was looking forward to it, but he might have been in solitary confinement in other prisons in California. And he said, in other prisons, it's really quiet. It's a peaceful place. You know, nothing goes, you know, it's just not much goes on there. But he said, I was surprised in San Quentin, it was crazy noisy. Everyone was, I guess there was a lot of people there, and they were all screaming and yelling, and he said there was never any moment of peace in this place, even though he was in his little cell by himself, you could hear everybody else. And he didn't know why he was there, so he spent the first 2 weeks, he said, standing in my cell, going over and over and over again, why was he there? This is not fair. I've done everything I could. I've done all these programs. I've done this, you know, becoming a peacemaker in the prison. And it doesn't make any sense. And this, what's going on? And, you know, dealing with us around and around the clock. And it's kind of realized, well, I guess it's my, you know, I have to keep dealing with the fact of my past. This is the consequences of my past, that this kind of stuff has to happen to me. But 2 weeks he stood there and just his mind was spinning and spinning, thinking about this, ruminating, going over and over again. And then after 2 weeks of doing this, he said, wait a minute. Maybe there's another way. And that's one of the advantages of being in prison for a long time, is eventually you think there has to be a different way. And I've met at San Quentin people who were some of the worst of the worst. And it took them 15 years in jail to kind of being the worst of the worst. Wait a minute. I think there has to be another way. And then they find another way. And the people I've met, the people I tend to meet, are really amazingly transformed people, beautiful people, transformed. And I wish people, you know, that I know outside of the prison were as transformed as some of these Was that the last one? Anyway, so after 2 weeks, he decided that he would maybe he should try meditating. So he sat down to meditate, and he was able to do it for 2 minutes because of how chaotic it was in solitary confinement, noisy and all that, and all this maybe his mind and everything. He could only manage 2 minutes. But he kept it up. And he kept coming back to it. And he kept a little bit each time. Is there trouble hearing out there? No? Not too soft? Can we turn up the volume in the outer hall? Maybe it's not on out there.
It's quiet.
I think it's quiet
in here. Is it? Mm-hmm. Yes. I see yeses.
Is that better? So is that better?
Yes. Yeah.
Great. So he kept at it. You know, you're 60 days in the hole, you have a lot of time, nothing else is going on. And so he kept doing it and doing it. And slowly, you know, 2 minutes and 5 minutes, it kind of slowly over the days increased until he could sit, meditate for an hour at a time. He kept doing it. And much of that, you know, that's what he did in prison, was to meditate. So he just kept it up and kept it up. And he said at some point, he was able to sit and meditate, and he dropped into a stillness. Everything became silent and still in his mind. And all this cacophony of the prison receded into the background. It didn't go away, it just receded in his mind. And his mind got completely still. He never had it before. But then he got excited. Oh! And he popped out of it. And he said, I have to learn not to get excited. And I drop into this level of peace and stillness. And that's how he managed for himself in the hole in San Quentin for 60 days. For, you know, and a certain level of injustice, a certain level of unfairness perhaps of someone who's following all the rules in the prison, living well, going through programs, changing himself for no reason of his own, no purpose, being given more punishment by going in the hole. This idea of finally giving up the ruminations of the mind, the spinning of the mind. And of course, I imagine that some of you have a similar experience where you're going around and you have something that's you've gotten in your head and you're kind of thinking about it, reflecting on it. Maybe it's some resentment that you're holding and you review over and over and over again. Maybe it's thinking about plans and futures and regrets or something that goes over and over and over again. And I think in ordinary, outside of the prison, outside of the solitary confinement, there's a lot of interruptions in our thought streams. And so we don't quite notice sometimes how repetitive they are and how we're caught up in them because we, you know, you have to get out, you have to go to work or you have to go do something. And so, but this man, you know, there was nothing interrupting him except, you know, because he was in the hole. And so he kind of realized, wait a minute, there has to be a different way. But sometimes it takes people outside of prison a lot much longer to think, oh, maybe this is not the way to do it. Maybe I don't have to keep doing this kind of mental activity of spinning and wondering and being afraid or whatever it might be. And that's why some people come to meditation. And meditation can be, it's multifaceted meditation. It works on many different levels, many different ways. It's not like, meditation isn't like just one thing. Mindfulness is not one thing. Certainly sometimes meditation is doing. We engage in certain practices that are beneficial and useful. We develop the mind. But sometimes what meditation is to stop the doing, to do nothing. And at some point, as people get better in meditation, to develop themselves in meditation, there comes a time when that becomes really important to learn not to do anything. Do less and less. And to learn, you're not just, you know, you're sitting still in meditation, you know, so you're not doing anything with your body particularly. And you've learned perhaps that to be relatively comfortable with not moving your body, being able to hold it still for 45 minutes or something. So that, you know, you're not doing anything with the body. But then you start learning not to do anything with your mind. To not review the past so much anymore, or not at all. To not plan the future, to not talk about the regrets, not plan revenge, not have some fantasy going on and on, some fantasy, and all kinds of fantasies goes on that we live in. Whatever it might be, not perpetuate fear. And to stop doing, and so the mind quiets down, and that doing quiets down, and it's quite lovely, more often than not, to have the mind quiet, because a lot of the agitation and stress we carry comes from the functioning of the mind, how we think and what we're concerned with and our emotional drives and feelings that are there. And so as the mind gets quiet, it isn't just that our thoughts quiet down, but the emotional apparatus, the emotional processes that are closely tied to thoughts also quiet down, especially the ones that are emotions that could be characterized as being agitated emotions, feelings. And they quiet down, get quieter and quieter. And if you have some ability to get concentrated or be mindful and some ability to let go and discover and let the mind get really still and quiet. So there's almost no activity going on, almost not thinking almost anything. So just to take thoughts, for example. So finally you come to a place and you're relatively quiet for you, calm. And the ordinary agitations of the mind aren't operating. And then, you know, the train whistle blows. And you're reminded that, you know, you've often thought how nice it would be to take an Amtrak vacation, a train trip across the country, go over the Rockies, it's supposed to be beautiful, and you start thinking, planning vacations, and you start thinking how great to be vacation, and how are you going to get the money, and you have this problem at work. And you watch this happen, and you watch as it happens that the mind starts getting agitated, gets busy, doing something it has done many times before, and maybe captivated your attention many times before, but because of the nothing as much as going on in the mind, you see it beginning. And you recognize at that moment that it's for your betterment. It's to not be involved in that, not do those thoughts, not get involved in them. Why bother? Why get from a peaceful state to a more agitated state? The activity of thinking about vacations and money for the vacation, you know, I can do that later. Why should I leave this kind of quiet, peaceful place? And you start seeing there's it's optional, it's a choice almost, whether to get involved in the more busy thoughts or not. And slowly what we can learn is how many states of mind, how many ways that the mind works are in fact mental activities that are not needed all the time. And then you start questioning the mental activities that you're doing. Do I need to involve in those activities? And it gets fascinating, very interesting as you get more and more quiet. So here's a mental activity that is not needed. It's the mind that makes it happen, makes it, does it, creates it. And nothing has to change in the external world in order for this particular mental activity to quiet down. And the evaluation that this mental activity has of the world disappears. And that's boredom. Nothing is inherently boring, except that there's a particular mental activity and evaluation that goes on in the mind that calls this, it sees this, it evaluates situation or anything, this is boring. And if you've ever been around kids, you could know how debilitating boredom is. It's a real, you know, and you kind of think, well, nothing's going on, that's why it's boring. But something is going on, the activity of boredom. And it's an optional activity. The mind doesn't have to be bored. But the feeling of boredom for many people is it's inherent to the system. It's inherent. It's just like things are, it's just boring. Thank you. But it's a particular neurons are firing in the brain. Particular thought processes are going on. And those don't have to be operating. The mind can get quiet. Feelings that somehow you are an inadequate person, or feelings that you're like the best, delusions of grandeur, whatever it might be, are mental activities. Anger is a mental activity. Resentment is a mental activity. Basically, anything going on in your mind is a mental activity. It's pretty shocking or pretty challenging to realize that what your mind is a mental activity or a series of mental activities that don't have to be operating. So to sit and quiet the mind, quiet the mental activity, and not do anything with the mind, just be, and be able to discover a reservoir, a pool, an ocean of peace, ocean of well-being, of happiness, of contentment, of satisfaction, that feels so good when the mind is not doing anything. The value of that is not so much that it's good that you have a calm, peaceful place. And I actually encourage you not get detached or too focused on getting peaceful. Like that's the aim, is to get peaceful. But rather, to get peaceful enough, still enough, so you can understand, so you have a window to understand mental activity. What is mental activity? To start seeing the mental activity start up again and see that it's optional. I don't have to do that. And that gives you a phenomenal leverage in your life to simply understand, oh, that's mental activity. And maybe in some circumstances, it's a very important mental activity and you choose to participate in it and do it. It has to be done. But part of the radicalness of meditation practice is it's meant to be one of the few places in human life where it's okay to do nothing. You don't have to solve your problems. The chances are all your problems, the only way you have a problem, you know a problem, or engaged in a problem, is mental activity. And that mental activity is optional in meditation. And can you put it down? Can you let it go to rest? Or do you carry, or do you keep perpetuating involved in doing more of it? And some of you, I'm sure, will think, I'm not doing it. It's just like, you know, that there's no one at the driver's seat, but this car is going. You know, the mind's going, but, you know, and after all these Buddhists, they say there's no self, so I'm not doing it, it's just doing itself, right? And sometimes that's just an excuse to let it keep going. I'm not doing it, I'm just letting it be. But to start, you know, so it's a really radical thing to do, this insight, this perspective, because to understand what is, just understand mental activity as mental activity is to, it gives you a different perspective to deal with what goes on in your life, in your mind. You don't have to understand the mental activity, you don't have to justify it, you don't have to analyze it, you don't have to get all complicated about what is it and why should it be there and needs to be there. In certain settings, like meditation, just see it, oh, just mental activity. So, for example, you might think that you need to figure out the meaning of life soon. And you have these big existential issues. And maybe you should think, maybe it's a good thing to think about. I don't want to disparage anything, that everything in its own time and place. But if you understand that wanting to discover the meaning of life is a mental activity, just a mental activity, then maybe in meditation just put it down. I don't have to do that. As opposed to solving it or figuring it out and all that. Or if you're confused about what the meditation instructions are, what should I be doing here? Confusion is a mental activity. Maybe it's not needed. So rather than solving your confusion and getting books out and reading about meditation, it could be a lot easier. And then, oh, it's a mental activity to be confused. And it's just a mental activity. The mind, that's what the mind does. And I can maybe put it down, or let go of it, or not be so complicated with it. Just mental activity and rest. So the idea of doing nothing is a powerful teacher. We can learn so much about ourselves by doing nothing. One of the things we learn is how difficult it is to do nothing. And that's a useful thing to see. One of the things we learn is some of the strong forces within us, beliefs, thoughts, feelings that we have, that tells us that no, it's not good enough to do nothing. I have to do it something. Something has to happen now. I have to fix this problem. I have to figure this out. I have to, this happen. And maybe in outside of meditation, maybe that's true. But this is where I think, again, to repeat, where meditation is so radical, such a radical teacher, because it can be the one place where you don't have to figure things out. You don't have to solve your problems. You don't have to better yourself. You don't do anything. But you can learn something radically different, which is to learn to put the mind into a peaceful place. Do nothing. And then from that place, you get tremendous insight into the mental activity when it starts up. When all the mental activity is going all at once, a lot of mental activity going on, we don't see it as mental activity. We see it as whatever the thoughts, the fantasy, the beliefs, whatever is going on, and sometimes we're multitasking in there in the brain, right? It's not just one thought, but you know, it's all these things going on, and so we're just caught up in the content, the thoughts, the ideas. And that's what some of these inmates at San Quentin were like for, you know, 30 years, 15 years, 10 years before they realized there has to be another way. Part of the discussion on Friday from these inmates, they were being taught as part of their program the difference between original pain and secondary pain. And say sometimes you shouldn't be dealing with your secondary pain, you should deal with your original pain, because the secondary pain comes from the original pain. If you take care of that, then the secondary gets taken care of. And somebody with great eloquence, actually one of the prisoners performed a spoken word poem. Beautiful, kind of a little bit rap-like, beautiful poem about this difference between his secondary pain and the first pain. And some of them talked about their crime they did, or, you know, how much it was really a secondary from the, you know, because they weren't dealing with original pain. And a few of them talked about their original pain, and this poem, this beautiful poem, was the abandonment of their father. In this poem, he talked about, I think he was 5 years old, and how parents were separated, and how proud he was to have a father. And his father would come on the weekends to see him. His father was an important guy, and you know, just like, oh, my dad, and we would do things together, and like, it was really, he looked forward to it, it was so important. And then one weekend, he was waiting for his father to come, and he didn't come. He never came again until he was a teenager, but then... And that was his original pain. So the second, so these like mental, it's all mental activity, and it takes a lot of care, a lot of compassion, a lot of tenderness, to become still and quiet enough, with that kind of deep primary original pain, and to watch these guys in San Quentin touch it. And realize it, and take responsibility for it, and practice with it, and get still and quiet, to meditate with them. It's great to meditate. How often do you get to meditate with 20, 21 murderers in the room with you, touching them side by side? It was a powerful thing to see, to be there. If you have enough time, you can learn to do nothing. And it's not nothing to do nothing. It's not like invaluable. Doing nothing in this way that I'm talking about is, it's like, it is something, boy. It's, I recommend it. It's really great, but don't get excited. That's just more mental activity. So I offer this talk to you as a little bit as a challenge for you to reconsider what you notice about your mind, to reconsider what you notice about what goes on when you really pay attention to yourself, and what your relationship is to your mental activity, and how you justify it, how you get pulled into it, how you get caught in it, how you ruminate in it, how you, and not just your thoughts, but also some of your feelings that you have, the emotions you have, the attitudes you have. None of those things are inherent to the mind. None of those are necessary to always have in the mind. So to look at it, and if you look at it, oh, that, if you can quiet enough just to be able to see it as just, oh, it's just mental activity. The just is not to dismiss it or disrespectful for it, but just say, oh, it's mental activity. And there is another way. There is some another way of being. I don't have to be involved in mental activity. I can let it become still. I can let it relax. I can let it rest. I can just be. I don't have to do anything. Nothing to do. Nothing to do. That could be your mantra. And see what happens. See what you learn. See if it provides a very radical, useful perspective in which to see yourself in ways you've never seen yourself. The quieter the mind gets, the stiller the mind gets, the more peaceful the mind is, the more insight, the more clarity you'll have of what's how your mind actually works. And that clarity translates to freedom, translates to really not being an automatic pilot with it all. Learn how to be wise with it all. So that was a very long-winded way of wanting to say maybe we should not do much. We shouldn't say much. Just be here and quiet. And maybe, you know, we spend the next 10 minutes, we have 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, doing nothing. See what happens. What would happen to you? How many of you are ready to bolt? Can I sneak out? You got to be kidding. Let me sneak out. So what questions do you have? What comments would you like to ask about what I've said? Clarification?
Hi. I have a little trouble with the idea that you have a choice. I think sometimes you do on what you think. But I've experienced some uncomfortableness and anger where there's this tape that goes on and on and on, and I try all kinds of techniques to get rid of it and this and that, including just observing it. And I had a tape that went on for a full year with someone I had a real problem with. And I did everything I could to stop that tape, and it wasn't a choice. It just kept going on and on and on. And certainly there are times where you do have a choice, where there isn't a lot of emotional charge, but there was a tremendous amount of emotional charge, and I just couldn't get rid of it. And finally, it just kind of burned itself out. So, any comments you have on that?
I appreciate the comment, mentioning that. That's often can be the case. But I don't find myself very interested in the question or the concern that as you raised it, so I say that respectfully for you. What I find myself much more interested in is the comment that you're just a little bit troubled. I was kind of happy first that that's all it was, a little bit of trouble. You know, it means that you're not so troubled in general, just like a little thing, like, you know, a little wrinkle still left in the sheet that you've been ironing, and so that's good, to take care of the last little wrinkle. But what I find myself most interested in having given this talk is not to address the issue that you raised, because that's not here and now. Here and now, you're a little bit troubled. That's the mental activity that's going on for you. Are you able to see the value here and now of seeing that as a mental activity that you can put down? Is that necessary to be involved in that?
Yeah, it's not a huge consideration right now, but I mean, I'm just in the past what I was talking about, and it may happen again with some other issue, but I just couldn't control it. It just kept going on and on. And what I'm trying to say is I did not have a choice. I'm hesitant to get into victim land here on this, but that's the way I felt. My mind was just running off with me, and I couldn't control it. Yeah.
No, no, I very appreciate how you said it, and you're very articulate. It's very clear. You said it twice now. But I said I'm not that interested in addressing your very good concern, maybe partly because of the theme of this talk. What I'm interested in, generally what I'm interested in this kind of practice is here and now, what's happening now, which is happening, you know, which is today, Monday night, for you. And so what I find myself most interested in is that here and now what's happening for you is you have a concern. It's a good concern.
Well, it's kind of a precautionary thing, because if it happens again, you know, I was a Boy Scout and our motto was be prepared. So I just want to get, I just want to be prepared for if anything happens in the future where my mind goes off and off and on, you know. Right now, in the last few months, it's been okay. But
it's completely reasonable what you're asking. It's great. I commend you for it. It's nice. And you're pointing in a different direction than what I was pointing to in the talk. So because I just gave this talk, I'm interested in here and now. What's happening right now for you? And you keep talking about first the past.
What's happening right now is concern for the future.
Great. Now we're talking. concern about the future is a mental activity. Now, can you put that down? Are you able to let go of that and let the mind become peaceful, or are you kind of stuck in that mode?
Not particularly stuck on it. No, it's just something that I think ought to be looked at. I mean, it's like storing up food for the future or something. That's a sensible thing to do. Putting money in the bank, you know.
Yeah,
so it's sort of along that line.
I completely agree with you. It's great what you're saying, and the talk today was to offer an other possibility that's also useful at times. I'm not saying this is the only way to respond. What you're doing is a reasonable thing for any human being to do, and what you're asking, but it's not what the talk was about. And so I'm a little bit stickler right now. The concern for the future, storing up for the future, taking care of yourself, protecting yourself into the future is at times a great thing to do. But here and now, does it have to happen right now?
Well, let's suppose that it was happening right now. Then how would you handle it?
And then what would happen if you just saw it as mental activity?
Yeah, I tried that at the time, but like I said, it didn't work.
Good luck. After that, no one's going to be willing to ask anything. Given that what I meant was the way I responded, no one's going to be willing to ask anything.
Hi, Gil. How does one strengthen one's practice to move this off the cushion? Stillness like this? How does one strengthen one's practice to move these moments of stillness and the insight and the clarity off the cushion?
Mm. Well, I think that what I said, that it isn't the stillness that's important, really, in the long term. What's important is, to whatever degree of stillness, quiet we have, to learn from, study, become wise about how we lose that. So when we start getting agitated, get interested in that. Sometimes people who do a lot of meditation are more interested in getting calm, and that's where they put their focus on, but when they come out of meditation, they don't give equal amount of attention to what it's like to come out of meditation, and when they start getting more agitated. And I would like to encourage people to actually, it's maybe more important to be mindful of what happens as you leave meditation than when you go into meditation. So that's when you start reappropriating your ideas, your feelings, your motivations, your things you're concerned with. And there's something very significant about watching it return. And you can sometimes see it in a much wiser way, see more, have better understanding of it. And the more you become self-understanding of all these mental activities, how they work, how they do their tricks, how they you cut into them, get involved in them, then that translates into being wiser in daily life, watching and seeing how this works in daily life. You understand, you're wiser about it, you see it coming, you know how to operate with them. So that's one way. How does that sound? Time for one more? Quiet group. I hope it's a good sign. Nope. We have more.
At various times, I find that it's very easy to do nothing and have my mind, just like when I was sitting here, my mind was absolutely quiet until I came to the place of wanting to voice this. And I used to call it, when I worked with the elderly, the psychology of being versus doing. And I guess what I'm concerned about is when I seem to be able to spend a lot of a significant amount of time in just beingness, being, I end up afterwards feeling guilty because our culture doesn't value it.
Mm-hmm. So. What's the connection between a culture that doesn't value it and you being guilty? How does that, what's the logic of that connection?
At the moment, I don't have an answer, but I guess for me, when I've gone counter, when I've been in counterculture,
yeah.
Or someone asks me, what are you doing? And I'll say, nothing. What are you thinking about? Nothing.
It's probably then the solution is don't offer that as the answer. Figure out a different answer that's honest, but you know, because it's just confusing for people. Most people don't understand about nothing and doing nothing, and it's just confusing for them. So, out of compassion for them, come up with a different answer.
What would be yours?
Well, you could say I'm just peaceful right now. I'm enjoying my peace right now. That's what's happening. For example. Or, I'm taking a vacation from my neurosis.
I like that also.
And then people will applaud you. Oh, you should do that more often. How can I help? Great. Anyway, so I hope this talk has challenged you to... It's a very simple approach to practice that is applicable everywhere. Do you see it as just mental activity? And is the mental activity necessary? And in some settings, like in meditation, it's many of the things we do are not necessary. And that's where your freedom can be found. Great. Enjoy. Thank you.